Hello, everybody. This is Josh Placer from GameWisdom.com, where we examine the art and science of games. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. We've got a great cast for you tonight. First, welcome back to the cast, GameWisdom's contributor and my on-again-off-again podcast co-host, James Ellerby.
Hi, guys. I'm the intern.
It's great to have you back on, James. I know we missed you a few times with recent episodes.
Yeah, computer is getting into an argument. We might be breaking up soon. So
I know it always happens, like every few years for everyone, or if you have the money, every few days, I think, for sometimes. But our main topic tonight, we're going to be talking about another part of being an independent developer, and that is the challenges of not only running your own studio, but also some of the hardships that can happen. And my guest tonight is co-founder of the studio Stellar Jockeys. They recently released their early access game, Brigador, and he's going to be here tonight to talk about developing the game, as well as some of the difficulties he's ran into with getting the game out there. So, please welcome to the podcast, Hugh Monahan.
Hello, thank you for having me. So I was I'm one of the co-founders of Stellar Jockeys, as you mentioned. My brother and I are the two kind of core members. Although there were four of us over the development, working together on the development of Brigador, the other two were contractors for the duration. So they've since moved on to greener pastures. But I focus mainly on game design and running the business, while my brother handles the art end of the spectrum. Brigador is our first game. It took us several years to make, and we released it on early access October of last year, and then the game hit 1.0 on June 2nd of this year.
Yep, it's great to have you on, Hugh. I know we've been talking about doing this for the last few weeks. Always the challenges of playing email tag, but it's great to finally have you on, and we can sort of have this sit down discussion.
Yeah, I'm happy to chat about this stuff.
Yeah. And for those of you who missed it, Hugh made a post, I think, was an interview on Kotaku that you did regarding Brigador's development?
Yeah, I spoke with Nathan Grayson at length. It was my brother and I both. Talked to him for a couple hours, and then most of the transcription of that interview ended up going up on Kotaku.
Yeah. And we'll be talking a lot about the topics that you brought up there regarding especially the challenges of developing a game, especially developing an indie game in the current market. As we were talking about before the cast, there's always a lot of discussions about the big name games, the ones that have succeeded, Darkest Dungeon, Undertale, Stardew Valley. But for every amazing indie game that gets in the spotlight, there are countless more that unfortunately fall by the wayside for one reason or another. And I was talking to James about this before as well. As someone who's also trying to learn more about the workings of game design industry, and this is a really great cast for you to sit on. And if you have any questions for Hugh, James, feel free to speak out.
Yeah, definitely.
So to get things started, then, you already gave a little bit of discussion about your background, Hugh. For people who haven't heard of Brigador, could you talk a little bit about what the game was about and sort of what you were going with it?
Yeah, sure. So Brigador is the technical definition, I guess, is it's an isometric, real-time tactical combat game. The short version is that you drive around tanks and you blow shit up. We did a custom engine specifically to the ends of making fully destructible environments. And when I say fully destructible, I mean that, like, if you see it in the game outside of, like, the boundaries of the level, if you see it, you can blow it up. We've had some people affectionately call it a Kool-Aid Man simulator, which I get a good chuckle out of. The goal with the game was to make something that straddled the gap between a twin stick shooter versus something more like a tactics game, where you still have that the skill still lies in your ability to pilot and aim your vehicle, but to take the twin stick formula, slow it down. and make it a lot more involved. So, for example, the aiming in the game, you're aiming in three space. Mm-hmm. So simply having the correct orientation for landing a shot on your target isn't sufficient. You also have to have the correct declination of the guns. Now, all that's controlled by the mouse control. But yeah, I mean, so it's a weird kind of straddling of a couple different genres. People would probably most recognize something like Desert Strike or Bedlam. We get a lot of people referencing Future Cop LAPD as well. Something in that wheelhouse, and you haven't really seen any games trying to hit that niche.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a lot of like subtle complexity to Brigador, including the free play mode or the contract mode, where you're basically free to just pick a pilot, pick a mech, pick their weapons, and then you're basically able to just create semi-customized scenarios to go out and play the game, and then you can unlock more money, which can get you more resources to do more with that.
Yeah. That was to kind of jump into talking about early access. The way we'd originally scoped the game was that it was just a freelance mode. It was It was more of like an arena style game where you have different loadouts. You go in and you either beat a series of levels or you die, start again. And one of the strongest sets of feedback we got from the early access release was that people wanted an explicit story campaign and one which was sort of discretized down to single levels. And what that ended up basically extending an already long development cycle by about another 6 months so that we could do this different kind of more catered mode for players. It ended up being very popular. So it was the right decision. But we ended up with this sort of a game with a couple different ways of interacting. I think it turned out all right.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting that you talked about the campaign or the story mode being added in after the early access period, as the game has a very extensive amount of lore to it. And we talked about this through email a few weeks ago, but there's actually a companion novel to Brigador that's available. I think it's an ebook, right, on Amazon?
Mm-hmm.
So did that kind of lore, was that something that you had in mind from the outset of developing the game? Or did that sort of develop over the course of pre-early access into the early access and then into release?
It was a sort of natural progression. Brigador actually, the setting for it is actually a modification of something that we had been working on, mainly my brother actually, for a couple years prior to jumping on and starting Brigador. So it was a setting that we had actually spent a lot of time thinking about, and it had always been intended to be something we use for a video game, but at the time we didn't have a very specific thing to be doing with it. We had a couple years of basically thinking about what exactly we want that setting to be prior to actually starting the game. And then once we got knee deep in developing Brigador, we realized that setting that we had created prior was actually a very good fit for it. And as we continued working on the game, you know, we had this bevy of ideas and of story that meshed well with the game that wasn't necessarily it helped set the game, but we didn't want it to be the primary emphasis of the game. Mm-hmm. The basic setting of Brigador is that there's an outer world colony that was founded by one of these big mega corporations. Think like Weyland-Yutani from Alien. And then the colony nationalized, kicked out the corporate overlords, and built these giant orbital defense batteries as a precautionary measure should they ever try to come back. So the corporation does come back, but rather than try to do some sort of very expensive, very costly direct invasion, they end up taking over the planetary networks and bribing everyone to just start wreaking havoc and destroying all of these defensive infrastructures, all the defensive infrastructure, and kind of decapitating the leadership. So in the game, you play one of the titular Brigadors, these people who take the bribe. And there's all these different stories we wanted to tell within that, as well as, you know, the great leader who, you know, orchestrated a lot of this defense in the first place, who then is killed in the process. There were, we had spent a lot of time establishing what we found, what we thought to be an interesting universe, but we didn't, a lot of those stories didn't necessarily mesh well with the type of gameplay we had built. So rather than shoehorn that in, we decided to just sort of offload that impulse into a separate work. The writer, Brad Buckmaster, that was actually a very felicitous and fortuitous engagement. He was just a friend of ours who was doing some consulting with us. He's a veteran of several tours in Afghanistan. He's very knowledgeable about weapons and military. And so he was working with us to sort of lend more of an air of authenticity to a lot of this military writing that we were doing and to just the environment as a whole. And we found out that he actually was an author himself and was one of these like, well, you know, what if we ended up working together on this in a more established fashion? And we ended up negotiating something that was amenable to both parties. And next thing we know, you know, we were still about a year and a half out from finishing the game, and we've now got a guy working full time writing a book for it too. And then that, you know, we liked that so much that ended up snowballing into hiring Ryan Cooper, who's a voice actor, to do the audiobook adaptation. So we kind of went full bore on the whole thing. I don't know. I'm proud of what we made. I don't know if it made economic sense, but.
And it's very fascinating, again, about this kind of lore. As you were just saying, Hugh, that Brigador, from a gameplay perspective, doesn't lend itself to sort of the slower pace of, you know, a grand tale. It is a game, as you said, where you drive a tank and blow shit up. It's not a game that's going to stop for a cutscene to tell you everything. But while I haven't had a chance to look at the book yet, just looking at all like, the little lore snippets in the game, again, it's very fascinating about this kind of world that you built up. And as you were saying, it is something that you've had in the, like, the back of your head for a while before adding it to the Brigador kind of into its theme. Now, it's an interesting part, especially about storytelling games, and probably storytelling as a topic in of itself is something too big for this podcast. But if you remember, James, we did have that discussion about sort of the different kinds of storytelling.
Yep. I think it's really amazing that, like, didn't you say it was just you and your brother that kind of started this? And all of a sudden you guys have, like, a professional writer and professional voice actors. And it's amazing how the electronic entertainment gaming industry can collab with so many other industries to create what it is. And I think your story is a beautiful example of that.
Well, thank you. A part of it comes down to sort of design philosophy. My brother and I both are, I love games that tell a story. I want there to be something as a player to chew on, but at the same time, I also don't want it to get in the way of the game itself. And that's probably one of my largest criticisms of a lot of current games is when the story takes precedence over the gameplay. Or when the game itself is really just a scaffold for a story. That's just not the type of, those aren't the type of games that my brother and I are interested in making. And as a result, we had very particular sensibilities for how we wanted to go about integrating a story into the game. So part of that was just offloading this proper linear narrative into a book. And the other component was just that we wanted to have this, we wanted the game to have a multi-person narrative, and one which is just sort of left open to how you as the player want to invest into it. Insofar as like you know, take for example XCOM, one of my favorite games. You don't, in the original XCOM, like, you don't even have like character bios or anything. All you have is a face, a name, and their abilities, and then whether they live or die from combat. And you have some of these very memorable and just sort of tremendous moments in the game where, you know, things are going terribly, and then you have this rookie who nails this amazing shot from, you know, halfway across the game world. Or to the flip side of that, you know, the hardened veteran who misses a shot from 10 feet away and then ends up getting everyone killed. These kinds of things where you have this sort of implicit story created by the gameplay. That's something that I was interested in with Brigador, where we have a lot of these elements in combat in the game that they're not explicit objectives or explicit penalties. So there's civilians on every level. As a player, it's entirely up to you with how you actually want to play that. It's possible. It's very difficult, but it's possible to play through these levels without killing any civilians. They react to weapon impacts and to proximity and to noise. So you can basically herd them away from combat areas. excuse me. There are different ways you can engage with that. And the similar kind of thing just with overall collateral damage. I mean, we have some levels that are kind of out in the boonies, nothing really of value that can be destroyed. But then we also have ones where it's, you know, you're in a dense urban center, bunch of civilians, bunch of, you know, building infrastructure and things. And depending on how you want to play and also what your equipage is, there's this internal narrative from a player standpoint of, okay, I'm the Leviathan just stomping through everything and, you know, using these giant mortars to level half the city. Or, you know, I'm playing as this little stealthy hovercraft who ends up just taking out his targets and no one else, getting get out and, you know, kind of Hitman Silent Assassin style. We wanted to put the emphasis on that, which I think we achieved. The problem is just that I think a lot of people came into the game expecting more of a traditional linear narrative there and ended up coming away disappointed by that, by the lack thereof. And it's hard to respond to that by saying, you know, oh, we'll just read the book. like, well, you know, I bought a video game and I wanted to get that through the video game.
Yeah. And that's always a tricky part about storytelling. Again, the topic of storytelling can easily take up several podcasts just in of itself about how much you want to show versus tell the player. And especially when you have something that has a very meaty background like Brigador, and even when we talked about like the Soul series and how there's an extensive amount of lore and backstory to these games that is pretty much like ignored by like the actual game itself. Unless you actively want to look at it, it's not going to present itself. And as you're saying with Brigador, Hugh, it kind of falls along that same line. So if you just want to be a giant tank and blow stuff up, it's there. But then, of course, you have, I didn't even count like how many different lore entries are in the game plus the companion book.
Yeah, I mean, so as far as a proper accounting of things, the book is about 20,000 words. Or sorry, 75,000 words. So about 200 pages. The game itself on top of that has about 20,000 words of writing. So all told, we've got about 280-ish pages, standard paperback size of writing done for the game. I love Dark Souls and I'm a big fan of this sort of peripheral storytelling where if you want to dig in, if you like the lore, if you like the world that we've built, there is this wealth of writing and information for you to absorb. But if you're just there to blow stuff up and you don't care about any of the rest of the stuff, it is in no way demanded of you that this kind of stuff, that you need to read or to learn any of this kind of stuff. I think we might have erred too far on that side of things with the story campaign, just in that we were very hands-off about it. We gave sort of the primer for the campaign. There's different pilots you can choose to run each mission with. But we didn't have, as far as like the denouement for the campaign, we kind of left it fairly open, and I think people were expecting more of a discrete story and a very open and shut, like, you know, closure, like, okay, here's what happened to the city, here's what happened to you and everything else, whereas we sort of kept it vague.
Yeah, and as you're saying, not a lot of games do that. I know with the Souls games in particular, I think we had a pretty interesting discussion about like the fact that each Souls game basically just ends. Like, there's very little that's actually explained. And again, that kind of peripheral storytelling is something we really haven't seen all that often, at least in terms of the scope of the game industry. Most of the games we've played, at least growing up, were basically, you save the princess, kingdom's yours, the bad guy's beaten, that's it, kind of thing. And it's kind of, as you were saying, James, earlier, we've really been seeing this evolution in terms of storytelling, and especially with trying to elevate these kinds of, not just storytelling, but game design in general. Now, with Brigador itself, one part that I want to touch on, we sort of brought this up a few minutes ago, is the early access period. We've been talking to a lot of developers over the last year regarding their thoughts on early access, especially as not just a promotional tool, but as a way of enhancing a game. Now, I'm sorry if you said this already, Hugh, but is Brigador like your first like official game you've worked on?
It is my first ship title, at least on a commercial standpoint. I've worked on small projects prior to starting Stellar Jockeys, but either I was operating in such a minor capacity that I wasn't credited, or these were just projects that never made it to market, so don't really count. So yes, for all intents and purposes, this is my first ship title.
All right. So I'm curious about your thoughts on this question then, Hugh. As this being like your first official ship title, and as well as your first title to go early access, what did you think of the program?
I mean, I think early access, it's very valuable. But it's very much sort of a Wild West right now as far as getting coverage and as far as player expectations go. Something I would change... just from our own experience working on the game, working on Brigador, going through early access, is that I would not have sent out review copies during the early access launch. A lot of outlets either just ignored us entirely or reviewed us as if it were a finished title. You know, because you look at games like Darkest Dungeon, when that game released on early access, it was more polished than a lot of finished games. And as a result, I think... that has skewed the expectations a lot. And also, from a developer standpoint, you have a very limited amount of social capital when working with the game's press. And unless you are a very big deal, in which case you're not really concerned about getting press to begin with, all you can really count on is people covering you when you announce and people covering you when you release, and that's about it. And I think we, in pushing our early access launch as hard as we did, we got a little bit of coverage on that. But I think that hurt our launch for 1.0 as far as getting people to pay attention to cover it. And also, it for what we needed from early access... it did not need to be a publicized thing. Like we didn't launch early access as a money grab. It was specifically to start getting gameplay feedback. And we ended up, a lot of the people who ended up being our sort of core testing base were people who were going to buy the game anyway, who had either heard about it prior, or were already acquainted with it in some fashion. And so the publicity, what little publicity we did get from, heavily announcing an early access launch didn't really, gain us much.
And I'm I'm kind of surprised that people, when you originally put it on Early Access, that there were outlets that thought that the game was considered done.
No. It was more just that they judged it as if it were.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that is a very good point. I think it's going to be one we're going to expand on in the coming minutes when we talk more about sort of being an independent developer today. But that is, it's always very challenging. I think you made a really good point about how the perception of Early Access, and even by extension, the perception of Kickstarter and crowdfunding, is kind of, it's very wide right now. On one end of the spectrum, like with Early Access, you have games like The Darkest Dungeon that when it gets on Early Access, it's pretty much like 75-85% done. Like, you know, when you play Darkest Dungeon, the very first version, you have a pretty good idea of what this game's going to be like. Like, it's not going to change, it's not going to grow. And then on the flip side, you have a lot of games that enter Early Access at, like, probably like alpha 0.001, and what it's going to be like in 6 or 12 months from now could be fundamentally different than where it was at the start. And as the consumer, it's very easy to basically judge all Early Access games the same, just as it's easy to look at crowdfunding games as the same way, that because one guy was able to make this massive game on $250,000, how dare you suggest you need similar amounts for your game when it looks nothing like it. And part of that, I think, is also the issue with the perception of game development. And I was having a conversation about this on Twitter and YouTube. By the time you're listening to this cast, it would be a few weeks ago. But we talk about how there really isn't a lot of proper education and proper understanding about what goes into game development from the consumer side of things. And that's another reason that I find that I think it was great to have you on for this cast, James, to sort of hear these things. Because a lot of what goes into making a game is not really explained, or at least explained upon or on reputable channels.
That's true, yeah. I have a question. I just wanted to know if, like, do you, for this, would you say you blame Early Access on some of the negative sides or aspects of the game itself, like as far as like how it was received by the general audience, Early Access, do you think?
So to be clear, you're asking if I think Early Access was the cause of some of the negative perception?
Yes.
I mean, like when? Just from the release, like from the 1.0 release?
From Early Access to release. Do you think what was, I'm sure as a business model, you had projected sales. Do you think from the projected sales to the actual release date from the early, do you think Early Access had anything to do with, do you think that changed a lot?
I think the Early Access reviews didn't do us any favors. Like I said, if I could do it again, I would still do Early Access, but I would do it very quietly. Like I would love to have had access to Itch.io's, what are they called? The program. Let me look at this. Itch.io has, I mean, basically it's their version of Early Access. The difference is that you have much finer control over who gains access. It's called Refinery, excuse me. So Itch.io Refinery, it's basically Early Access, but where the developer has a lot more control over it. And also just Itch.io is a smaller platform. So for a game like Brigador, what I would have preferred, because we definitely did better, the game itself benefited tremendously from having that feedback. And your interaction with players is fundamentally different if you are giving access to a private beta versus people paying for access to the game. Like that actually is a very important step, and one that it fundamentally changes how you interact with your player base. And so for us, I mean, definitely could have, we benefited from having paid users in the game. The problem was that we had no control over what those expectations were for people coming in. You know, like you can do a Steam splash page, but even then, like Valve has very specific rules for how you set that up. and for kind of what you're telling people. And also early access itself on Steam has these kind of embedded expectations and understandings. Refinery, I don't think, has the same kind of baggage. And also giving you that control, we would have done a much smaller launch with early access, very carefully expanded when we took new users in. And also we wouldn't have publicized it at all. It just would have been, we get this small group of guys, we figure out, you know, what do we need to build up, what's wrong, etc., and then do this one big press push for the 1.0 release. Because the other thing, too, is like we had a lot of people who looked at the game back at early access, deferred reviewing it in any capacity. But then because of what they had seen on early access, I mean, we were pretty rough around the edges with our early access launch. They never bothered to go back to it. Even though we ended up with something dramatically different. So it's a tricky thing. I think a lot of it depends as well on the type of game you're making.
Yeah, and that's when we've talked to several guests about in the past that some games are just a lot harder to have on early access compared to others. Like, for instance, the survival genre or open-ended games really do well on early access because, in fact, they're meant to be something that can be replayed, and you can see that evolution very easily. When you're developing a game around a linear set of mechanics or something with a set amount of gameplay, it's very easy for someone to come in when the game's at its worst looking, play and go, oh, I don't want to play this again. And then when you have it completely polished, they're just like, look, I've already played this once. Why should I come back to it now?
Do you think, I mean, if you've got a story game, don't put it on early access.
Yeah. What were you about to say, James?
I was going
to
say, do you think that indie developers should start? I mean, it's one of those things. One of two things is going to happen. Either the reviewing community is going to have to, I mean, you can say what they want about the early access and have that opinion, but then come back to it and give it a fresh look, a fresh look and a comparative look from early access to opening day and release day. Or do you think indie developers are going to have to start, I don't know how to say this properly, but like are going to have to start designing their games with that in mind, that these reviewers are going to grab hold of the game, tear it apart in early access for whatever you give out, and then never, you know, not give it that second chance. You know what I mean? It's a work in progress. And yeah, you do have those wonderful gems that their early access copy is almost more complete than some people's final products. But it's almost like who has to change, the reviewer industry or the indie community?
I mean, I think the answer to that question is just don't send your game to reviewers when you go into early access. I mean, I don't know. Part of the problem is just that reviewers have the pick of the litter as far as what they actually look at and pay attention to. And you cannot rely on having a reviewer's eye or their time. From a developer's standpoint, advice that I wish I had had, and I think that is frankly valuable, even if it sounds a bit disparaging. I'm not saying they are this way, but from a developer standpoint, you need to treat press like the laziest sons of bitches in the world. Because in the same kind of way, like you hear a similar sort of thing with regards to sending out job applications or resumes and things, where it's like, don't like cut out any fluff, just like go straight to the point, be very specific, like, okay, here's what it is, like here's my resume, here's why you should hire me, etc. From a game developer approaching press standpoint, not like you basically need to think of it in terms of you are giving them an article to publish, as opposed to here's a thing that you should look at, digest, and then write something about. I think part of this just has to do with how a lot of games press are thoroughly overworked. And how, I mean, like some of the expectations, especially amongst like the major sites, like, you know, Kotaku, IGN, the turnaround these guys have on some of these articles is insanely short. So from a developer standpoint, it's like, if you can make their job easier, they're going to be generally more inclined to cover you. But also just that you, unless you are someone who is extremely important or who has made a big impact. So like if you are like a Stardew Valley or, you know, Darkest Dungeon or something, then, you can rely on being able to demand the time and attention of the game's press in a way that is, in a way that the vast majority of other indie developers cannot. Your relationship there changes fundamentally based on how much traffic you've already received to date and what your sort of established reputation is.
And then going back to what James was saying a few minutes ago regarding if reviewers should be able to or should go back and look over games, like give them a second look. As someone who's doing a lot more reviewing these days, it is very hard to do that. I think as you were just saying here regarding the timetable or the time frame for professional sites, for people who are doing stuff like what I'm doing with YouTube and writing, every day, I mean, this is probably will lead into talking more about the state of the independent market, but every day there are new games being released, and it's very hard to, again, split your focus, not just on games that are coming out, but games that have been out. And again, like as we were saying with Early Access, some games can enter and leave Early Access in fundamentally different places than they were. And the problem, of course, is that there's still only 7 days in a week and 24 hours in a day to do this stuff, despite the fact that we're being hit with, who knows, like, the amount, how much more games today than there were, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Now, I guess that, since we are approaching, we're about 40 minutes in, I know we're going to try to keep this to about, like, an hour, hour and 15, I think that's probably a good segue into talking more about the state of the independent market, especially again as a developer who's trying to make it big or, and try to get their game out there. So to sort of lead into that, now for those of you who listen to the cast, and since we haven't talked too much about how Brigador is doing, with that post or that interview on Kotaku, you kind of talk about the fact that the game has unfortunately not been meeting expectations.
I mean,
and how?
Sorry. Was there a question there, or?
I was going to say about for people listening, what is like the state of Brigador? Like, how well? Because it has been a few months, or I think about a month since it came out. How well has the game been doing on the market?
I mean, we're still a long way out from recouping our costs, which I think, given the scale of what we built, is still fairly modest. So, we might eventually break even. But the game's, it's never going to be a major money earner or anything for us, barring some kind of dramatic twist of fate. I mean, I'm proud of what we made, and I wouldn't change much of the game itself, were I able to go back. I mean, we certainly made a lot of mistakes, both during development itself as well as in approaching marketing, media, and things like that. So, you know, I'm not happy about it, but, you know, at this point, there's not really much else I can do about it.
I guess as a question then, in terms of like the overall feedback of the game, now we mentioned a few minutes ago regarding the story side of things, but in terms of like the gameplay and just like the design of the game, were there any like major complaints or like a common complaint you got back from reviewers or consumers?
The two biggest ones were just, you know, why isn't there more story? A lot of complaints about controls, which was very frustrating. There is a very low tolerance for, different control schemes. Particularly if it is both different and the game itself is challenging. And unless you embed that into the narrative of the game itself, it's very hard to get press to work through that. I mean, a game like Dark Souls, it has a reputation as like this is a hard game with, you know, and it had at the time when, you know, when Demon's Souls first came out, that actually was a relatively unique control scheme. Once it built up this head of steam, this reputation, you know, particularly by Dark Souls coming out, there was an impetus for people to work through and to learn those controls. With Brigador, so we do WASD and mouse, but it's tank controls, so A and D are going to rotate your legs left and right, and as opposed to pointing left on the screen and moving left. So between that and the very dense style of aiming, like it's not just pointing a direction on a right stick on a controller. Again, you're actually like choosing the declination and direction of two different guns that actually have, offset mounts depending upon what vehicle you're using. Like, so there's a tremendous amount of mechanical density there, and you've got things like directional damage and all, you know, and different damage types. What we found was that for people for whom that type of control scheme didn't immediately click, and there were plenty of people who, within 5 minutes of sitting down, seeing the game for the first time ever, are up and playing in a competent fashion. For every one of those, there were 9 people who were utterly befuddled by that control scheme. And that hurt us terribly. Reviewers either weren't inclined to learn the control scheme, or just wrote it off as being a bad control scheme, even though within the context of the game, it makes perfect sense. And once you learn it, like once it clicks, it's very enjoyable. So yeah, no, we pretty much every single review of Brigador, complains about the control scheme. If there's one thing I could change, I still prefer that control scheme as like, that is what the game was built for. That is the dominant control scheme, but we could have launched it with this alternate version, which is essentially much more simplified, handles orientation automatically for you. And it's much more similar to what people are used to with twin stick shooters. If we had launched with that as a toggleable option, I think we would have gotten both much more favorable reviews, and especially if we had launched with that as well as controller support, we actually might have been able to get more reviewers to spend time with the game. But instead, right now we're standing at a 70 on Metacritic, and just getting shellacked on the controls standpoint. For something that we had built that implementation and intentionally left it out because from a design standpoint, my philosophy was, I don't want to provide the rope for the player to hang themselves. Because that simplified control scheme has a much lower skill ceiling. And if you actually want to be competent at the game, you are going to have to unlearn that, past a certain point. What I failed to adjust for was the fact that the majority of people never make it more than 10% of the game. Like, a vast majority of your purchasing users aren't going to play the game for more than a couple of hours, which a simplified control scheme, a skill cap isn't going to factor in there. And so, yeah, that was a genuine mistake on our part. And like, we stuck to our guns there, and I had a lot of arguments with customers about it. From the perspective of design, I think I was right. But from a perspective of like making a commercial product and maximizing what we actually earned with the game, it was absolutely the wrong decision. And if we had shipped with these sort of simplified controls, I think the game would have gotten a lot more traction than it ended up getting.
And controls is such a very understated part of good game design. It's very hard when you're going in with a unique or esoteric control scheme. There's a thing that we keep hearing that pretty much someone's going to play your game, and if they don't get hooked within like the first 15, 20 minutes of play, they're not going to keep playing. And it's one of the hardest things, especially for games like Brigador and titles that have a high skill, a high skill ceiling, when it's supposed to be something that's supposed to click, like, let's say, like 40, 50 minutes in, or let's say after a few hours of play, you're going to reach that point of competency, and then you can really start experimenting with the game. And those titles are just very hard. They're hard not only for the consumer, but again, hard for reviewers. As you were saying, with like getting the game in front of people, it's very hard to convince them that a game is worth your time. Unless, of course, it's, you know, the press is blowing up around it. And, I mean, for myself and with my YouTube channel and especially Game Wisdom, I try to give every game a fair shake. I try to look at it as much as I can, but it is very hard to motivate yourself to essentially, I guess, like try to relearn how to ride the bike again. Like, would you rather play a game that clicks within 3 to 4 minutes, or do you want to spend 2 to 3 hours and then seeing if it works at the end of that? And a lot of people prefer the 2 to 3 minute, you know, instant engagement kind of gameplay.
Oh, of course. Well, but that's also, I mean, if we really want to get into this, I find it curious that kind of a common narrative in the games industry is this complaint that we're not doing anything new. What that really means is, you know, if you're going to do something new, it has to be a low difficulty narrative game that is not very challenging. Because then you can actually get people to sit down with it and get invested. I mean, you look at something like, Firewatch or Inside. They're both excellent games. But if they are very easy games to engage with and to review, and I think a lot of that drives the traffic and the frequency with which reviewers engage with these types of games, because the demands upon you as a player are extremely low. That is as a developer, that was a great frustration of mine, and it's also very eye-opening for me, which is just that the vast majority of games reviewers are not hardcore level players. Like, we had a lot of guys, reviewers, come in and they couldn't use mouse and keyboard. And then, you know, so they ended up like fumbling awkwardly at the game for 20 minutes and, you know, it may as well, like, we would have been probably better off if they just hadn't even looked at the game in the first place.
It's really like the, I think going back to what you were just saying regarding innovation versus, you know, the mass manufacturer repetitive gameplay, it really is a catch-22. And that's, I think, something that a lot of new developers, especially students and enthusiasts, need to hear. Everyone says they want they want unique games, stuff that they've never seen before. But then when you have stuff that you've never seen before, it requires a lot more dedication to it. Recently I spoke with Abby Games on Renowned Explorers, which was one of my favorite games of 2015. It's an amazing game, but it's also something that is completely original. And that, as we're saying, is a very hard selling point. When you look at something like Undertale, it has the 8-bit aesthetic to it, like that quote-unquote retro feel to it. Same thing with Stardew Valley with 16-bit. Like, a lot of people, I think especially like reviewers and consumers, they tend to review these games first with their eyes. Because obviously video games are a visual medium. But there's a lot that goes on under the surface that, unless it's, you know, staring at them in the face from minute one, they're going to either not see or just simply ignore.
That, I mean, yeah, but there's a bigger problem here is, like, you have somebody trying to tell you, like, you just said the guy that, some of the people that were reviewing it weren't even used to using those kind of controls. That's horrible. That's like somebody who has, like, that's like a deaf person trying to review a freaking game done by Nobuo Uematsu. You know, like, this Final Fantasy game, the story was great, but the sound sucked. You're deaf. You can't hear anything. So how can you review this? How can you properly review something if you can't even properly play it? You know what I mean? That's not a fault of the game industry. That's a fault of the review industry. That's
well, that's kind of like the that's an issue that a lot of people are talking about, that there is no standard for what makes someone quote unquote be a game reviewer. Yeah. There's that piece that people made from a Polygon for with the Doom spotlight they did with someone who looked like they never picked up a first person shooter. But
yeah,
it raises a bigger problem, especially for independent developers, the fact that when you have something that you're trying to get critical feedback on, you have no idea the skill level of that person who's going to write a review for who knows how many hundreds of thousands of people are going to see. And it again goes back to the fact that being an independent developer these days is a very risky profession. And that's something that I don't think is said enough for people looking at the game industry these days.
Well, and it also really shows how, I mean, gaming has been around for quite a long time, yes. But in the grand scope of things, electronic digital entertainment has not been around for, like, if you compare it to something like books or food review, you know, those have been around for a lot longer. Like, if you compare it to that, then the video game industry is in its infancy. But something that really needs to happen is, like, if you go to, like, the news, like, the sports guys cover sports. They know sports. They love sports. Mm-hmm. They write about sports. And yet the game industry is still young enough that I'm a reviewer. Well, what do you do?
There's no standard. That's the
exactly.
issue.
But the thing that sucks is that people like you are going to suffer for it because of, you know what I mean? Like, that's not fair to the people that are, I mean, again, like you said, it is the Wild West, and that's kind of where we're at right now. But I think it's also something that we need to start looking to change industry-wise, where it's like, someone could have a great game, but all because it gets picked up by somebody that doesn't know what they're doing, it can completely ruin, like, everything. It can destroy a lot of stuff.
And as Hugh was saying earlier, when you were talking about like the difficulties of interacting with reviewers, there's also that kind of trouble with trying to even get their attention in the first place. Now, with when I think we got in touch, it was fairly easy. Like, I think I'm pretty sure I emailed you about Brigador after hearing about it on Twitter, and that was easy. But there are cases where you're trying to get in touch with someone and either they don't respond or, you know, they may want, I've heard quote unquote stories of professional YouTubers wanting to get paid to review their game, the sponsored content kind of thing. And there's just a lot out there that is more of, like, I guess the underbelly of what it means to, like, review these games and get in front of people.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and I think if you want to get paid, and here's the sad thing, though, too. Again, I think wanting more of a standard, especially when people's, you know, time, money, and art is on the line. If you want to get paid to review something, I think one of the standards should be, what are your qualifications? You need to start having some qualifications to start reviewing. You know what I mean? Like, because people are putting time, effort, and heart and money into these products. They need to be being reviewed by people who are also putting time, effort, and love of you know what I mean?
And I agree with you, James, but I can tell you exactly what the criticism of that will be. Mm-hmm. Some will say, but then, you know, we're going to then start trying to go back to that, you know, what is a gamer? People are going to try to say, oh, you're not a gamer if you don't play X, Y, and Z kind of argument.
Yeah.
Now, getting back to Brigador and sort of where it's at now, Hugh, one thing that was interesting, a few months ago I spoke with Skyshine's Bedlam, the developer behind that, and how they also ran into a lot of problems with the game from its initial release. Do you see you guys continuing to work on Brigador, or do you feel that it may be too far past the point of no return?
I mean, we just released a major patch that added controller support and a few other things, some more writing. The plan is to spend the rest of August doing major patching and trying to flesh out these kind of final components. But beyond that, I can't justify spending more time with the game just because sales being what they are. We need to be looking at what the next project is.
Yeah, and that's always like another major part of being an independent developer. We see a lot of developers, especially newer ones and people who are trying to establish themselves, with that risk of, do I continue working on a game or do I just cut my losses and move on to something else? Because we've seen cases where both are the right answer. For instance, Arkane Games has basically kept themselves supported thanks to their continued work and improvement on AI Wars. But in that same breath, they've also had games that were great in theory that they just had to, pull life support on because there just wasn't enough interest and they were just not earning enough back. Now, again, I mean, we can easily spend, I don't know, how many more hours talking about the industry, especially some of these challenges. Are there any like major points or anything that you mentioned in the Kotaku interview, which I'll put a link to below, that you want to bring up on the cast with us, Hugh?
I mean, that's tricky. At the end of the day, I love being a game developer, and I hope I can keep doing it. There's a lot of things. It definitely feels right now that as an independent developer that there's a lot of cards stacked against you. Especially if you... The sensible thing to do if you want to make indie games and do it in a commercially viable fashion, you need to not do anything interesting. And by that I mean there's this idea that... we talk about a lot about making something new, kind of innovating being a valuable thing. But often it's the second generation or second iteration on an idea that tends to be the most commercially viable. There are exceptions to that. And you've got these tremendous successes that are these sort of one-off types of games. You look at something like Papers, Please. I'm absolutely enamored of that game. And I love that it did very, very well commercially. It is a very difficult market, to penetrate if depending upon what you are trying to build and who you're trying to engage with. My biggest frustration is that, the gaming press has a tremendous role in visibility and awareness for a game. And the problem is that there are no, it's a very fickle process for actually gaining any kind of traction there. Like there's not, maybe it's the same on any artistic industry. Like there's no reliable way with which to get coverage or things like that unless you are very well established. So I don't know. I want to keep making games. I hope I can keep making games. I'm definitely on this next project, if I'm able to do it, going to very carefully reexamine how I approach development. Brigador as a game is almost tailor-made to not get coverage. It is a game that is mechanically complex. It has a unique control scheme on a mouse and keyboard platform. Like, it'd be one thing if it was a unique control scheme on controller, but it's a unique control scheme on mouse and keyboard. So just with those two things already... There are tremendous barriers for me to just get reviewers to even engage with the game in any meaningful fashion. And then, some of these other aspects as well. It's very hard to get, reviewers to look at games that are hard.
Yeah. And that, I think we could easily spend another hour or two discussing. I think, James, I think that will probably be a good, if we want to do maybe another double podcast one week, I think that would be a good topic for us to sit down and talk about, especially again, sort of my quote-unquote grizzled vet versus like your sort of like first step in.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I mean, I'd love to have Hugh back on. I mean, it's a real eye-opener as to what, like, you always hear the success stories, so everybody always thinks of the lights, the glitter and glamour of being an independent developer, and you don't hear this side of it, which you need to. You need to get this side of things.
Yeah. And again, it's a topic that is not going to be solved in one podcast, or even probably in like a we could cover this like every week. It's not going to get solved right away. There are definitely issues all across the board. And I think we had a lot of really good points. I definitely want to come back to sort of like that standard overview. I think that's something I want to flesh out into a post, maybe a video, even. I think that would be a good topic I want to talk with you about, James, as its own separate thing coming soon. Now, I think with that, again, we can talk. There's so many more topics about this, but I think we've hit all the major points for this post or for this podcast. To begin to wrap things up, Hugh, are there any final thoughts or anything in particular that we haven't talked about yet, either regarding Brigador or the indie market that you would like to touch on before we say goodnight?
Oh, no. I think I've spoken my piece.
All right. Well, it's definitely been a great cast. I think it's probably not exactly one of our more happier casts, but it is a very eye-opening cast. There's a lot of topics here that I think definitely deserve not only to be brought up more in normal conversation, but I think more that we need to start having here as well on Game Wisdom and with these casts. Mm-hmm. As James pointed out, these kinds of discussions rarely, if not at all, ever occur in the mainstream space. I guess as a quick question for you, James, as someone who's, again, someone coming in from the gamer side to sort of learning more about the industry, have you ever heard like these kinds of discussions happen?
No. Well, I've never heard the discussion. One of the most eye-opening things to me as far as the indie video game industry was I think it was a documentary on the indie game industry about, and it showed the guy that created Meat Boy.
Indie Game, the movie?
Yeah, Indie Game, the movie.
And yeah.
That was a few times I ever saw publicly, like, the true stresses of making an indie game. And it's funny, because even after watching that, I'd say this conversation and this podcast was way more eye-opening. It personally from somebody who's like, look, this is what we did, and this is what they did, and this is the results of that. So,
yeah. And again, there's not a lot of good information out there about what it means to be a developer. And I know there's students and a lot of first time, like people trying to build their first game thing that, oh, I'm just going to make whatever the hell I want. It's going to be an instant success, and then I'll have my own studio like Nintendo. But that's not going to happen. There's a lot of factors here, and there's even more that we didn't even touch on tonight, such as marketing and PR, which in of itself is a good hour and a half discussion, no matter however we slice it. But it's something that I think needs to be said more, and it's why I want to do more with Game Wisdom, to be able to have these kinds of discussions in the public space.
Yeah, and definitely giving developers like Hugh a voice. Like a true voice, an open voice that you can come on here and be like, look, this is what the industry is. It's who we are. We are real people. And this is kind of the stuff we go through on a daily basis. So,
yeah. And Hugh, I definitely like to thank you for coming on tonight. I know when I spoke with Sky Shines Bedlam, it's not easy talking about your game when it's not doing well. I mean, it's very easy to say, oh, my game, you know, talking to like developer of Undertale or Stardew Valley, it would be a much more uplifting cast. And especially talking with developers and following them for the last few years, it definitely hurts when I see that game doesn't do as well as it should. And I really do appreciate you coming on and sort of airing your frustrations with us.
Well, I mean, that's, like you said, this isn't something people talk about a lot, and we don't necessarily do a very good job as an industry of examining the not quite as successful stories. I mean, it's It's not sexy, so it's yeah. it's harder to get any traction there. But I do think it's worth talking about. And I mean, the irony is, of course, that I mean, I came across a couple examples of people who had similar experiences to me when I was working on Brigador. But of course, you have this mm-hmm. perspective as a developer, at least on your first rodeo, that's like, well, you know, I'm smarter than that. Like that sort of thing.
It's never
going to
happen to me.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's I'm always happy to chat about stuff, and you know, I may be wrong about things, but I'm trying to engage and learn, and hopefully I can be of a help to some other developer.
Yeah. All right. Like I said, this is not one of those topics that's going to go away, and we haven't solved it with just this hour-long discussion. I think we'll probably be touching on parts of this throughout the coming year. So, with that said, we're going to wrap things up. James, thanks for being my co-host, and I think you got a lot out of this one, just as me.
Oh, definitely. No, it was a real honor, actually, Hugh. Thank you. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, not a problem. And as I always say at this point, for those of you listening, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, there are multiple options available. First, if you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. I am looking for, well, anyone. As long as you're interested in talking about game design in the industry, we'd love to have you on, be it student, enthusiast, developer, whoever. If you would like to follow me, you can find me on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer for the latest updates of new content. And be sure to check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. There are links on the front page to it, where you'll find my collections of video blogs, let's plays, and examinations. And lastly, be sure to check out the Patreon campaign, where we're looking to get the much-needed monthly funding we need to keep going while supporting ourselves. There are new rewards up, including ways to get your own podcast once a month, and even write in questions to our future guests. You can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom, and like I said, any donations will be greatly appreciated. So, again, thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.